This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Now, about halfway through my BBC career, I moved up to BBC Aberdeen, and it was a really old-fashioned building, a lovely granite building with sort of pillars on the front of it and things, and it was a bit of a rabbit warren. As you came in the front door, if you turned right, there was an office, dark wooden panelling, proper desk, a really posh fireplace, as I remember. And sitting there was the boss man, Arthur Anderson. Arthur had a fascinating career in broadcasting. He started off as a wee farming loon. He's worked his way up. He's been literally all around the world. And he just produced a book chronicling all this called Wheels Rolling at Eight. And we'll explain that shortly. But take me right back to the beginning, you know, as a child.
Well, I was born at a wonderful place called the May Farm, which is in the Machars of Wigtonshire. And it was truly a magical place. My mother and father were tenant farmers of the May Farm. It was a large farm in terms of acres, 1,000 acres, but not like 1,000 acres you might find on the East Coast here. It was, a lot of it was kind of poor and grudging land, low-lying wet moor, useful for probably summering the sheep and nothing else. The main agricultural bit was about 150 in-by acres, and that held a small flock of sheep and 29 dairy cows. We had two byres, one for 13 cows, one for 17, although there was never 17 in the big byre, because the top stall was always reserved for the crossing bull. But it was a magical place to grow up as a boy. My mother and father worked very hard, of course, because you've got to if you've only got 29 dairy cows to try and earn a living from. But we used to, as a family, the three of us then, my young sister wasn't born in those early days, we used to go up to a hill called the Dune of May. And it wasn't a huge hill, but you got a wonderful panorama from there. If you looked one way, you could see the great stretch of the moors leading to Wigton Bay and then the great blue massif of the Galloway Hills beyond. Look another way and you saw Luce Bay and the Mull of Galloway. And on a good day of visibility, you would see Northern Ireland. And look another way and you would see more moorland, but you might just, if you're lucky, on a nice afternoon where the air was still, you would hear the whistle and the sound of a steam train, because it was on the line from Stranraer to Dumfries, and that would be the train stopping at Kirkcowan or near there.
You're painting an idyllic picture. At that time, were you going to be a farmer, or did you always plan to get off the farm?
No, I mean, in those days, I didn't know. I was just a little boy. But as I grew older, became a teenager, my mother and father prevailed on me.
They pushed you out.
Well, not quite. They probably would have done. I mean, as we all know, there is a great tradition in British agriculture of sons following fathers. But they kind of made it clear to me, and the evidence was there, that there was never going to be a rich living in that. In fact, I always joked that my mother and father represented, as best as anyone could, that old adage that they started with nothing and at the end had most of it left. Yes. My interest in journalism didn't start until much later, and I think that was when I was a young teenager and I read about the flight from Chinese oppression by the Dalai Lama over the Himalayas. And that somehow, somewhere, sowed a seed. Not that I ever thought that anything I did in journalism would be quite that dramatic to report on that.
By a strange coincidence, I was in the old Scotsman building the other day, and it's a hotel now, but it's quite a posh hotel. But, you know, you're walking down the marble stairs where only the management were allowed to go and things. And, you know, we didn't go right the way down to the bottom because, I mean, that was, you know, once upon a time, very dirty and noisy. But describe it to me. When, you know, that kind of environment, what was it like for a wee boy from Galloway?
It was, once again, a magical place to be. I mean, when I started there, which was just before my 17th birthday, I got the huge sum of £2.17 and sixpence a week. But within a fortnight, I became 17 and my pay just leapt to £3.10 a week. And that 10 shillings is important when you're just getting your first taste of beer and you need to buy cigarettes as well.
How did you get a job like that? I mean, you're a teenager in Galloway to the Scotsman, that's a big jump.
Well, I decided this is what I wanted to do, and I managed to get a place at a place called Skerries College in Edinburgh. I needed to learn typing and shorthand. And once I was there, and I was in digs, and my parents were still funding me at this time, I wrote to virtually every newspaper in Britain. Funny enough, one of the first replies I got was from the Scotsman, from the news editor, Stuart Brown, who said, can you come down and see me and we'll see what if there's any possibilities. And I went down, I saw him, and he offered me a job.
As what?
Copy boy. The lowest
boy.
Of all. Absolutely. You only answer to that one word of command, boy. With one exception, there was, would you believe it, a sub-editor there who went by the unlikely name of Arthur. Arthur was his Christian name and his surname, but there was much amusement in the subs room. One sub said to me, take this to Arthur.
What does a copy boy do?
Well, in those days, there are no such things as a copy boy now, but in those days, newspapers, particularly big daily newspapers, they had a system a bit like big stores did then, pneumatic tubes.
They made a very distinctive noise. I remember them in shops.
A pop, absolutely. Well, copy would come down from what we called the wire room, and that was the intake point for copy from Reuters, the Press Association, and Associated Press. And then it came in there, so you sorted it out, you gave it to the copy taster, and then he would decide who should get which story to do, whether it was a page lead or just a couple of paragraphs. And then once they had done their job, they shouted, boy, you collected the edited copy and you rolled it up, put it in this little tube and popped it down. And from that point, it went down to the case room. That's the wonderful place that used to smell of burnt toffee. The text was set up in hot type and the printers got to work on it.
So were you drifting towards agricultural journalism at that point, or was that still a long way off?
It wasn't a long way off, but I was ambitious, and not aggressively so, but I always thought, well, I don't want to do this for the rest of my life. And I actually, after the first edition of the Glasgow Herald went to bed one night, I went down for a pint in a little pub called Ross's Pub in a little lane that leads from Gordon Street to Buchanan Street. And who should be there but Ross Muir, who I had met earlier. And he said he was leaving the Scotsman to go into public relations in London. And I said, who's getting your job? And he said, I've no idea, why don't you apply? And I modestly said, oh, I don't think I've got the experience. Well, he says, you silly so-and-so, if you don't apply, what you'd never know. And what's the worst they can say is no. So I applied, and I got the job as assistant agricultural editor. A fine-sounding title, but in fact, there were only two of us. My boss was Bob Urquhart, a former squadron leader in the RAF. Then things happened. I went and became, after a couple of years, I went to become the Scottish man for Farmers Weekly for 4 years. And my place in the Scotsman was taken by Fordyce Maxwell. And then I went to a local radio in Carlisle. It's now Radio Cumbria, but it was Radio Carlisle then.
Well, why that jump to radios? Is just inability to stay in one place for 2 years.
Well, there's a very simple reason for that. I was in Farmers Weekly, and I got a phone call one day from a BBC producer called Roy Gregor, who produced the Farm Journal programme, a daily 10 minutes from Queen Street in Edinburgh. And he said, look, we're very busy, but we've just heard that a chap called Willie Young, who was then the chairman of the Scottish Milk Marketing Board, was going to be the first man to import Simmental cattle into the UK. And I gather you're going to do a story with him for Farmers Weekly. I said, yeah. He said, will you do a radio interview? Oh, I said, I don't know how to do that. He says, come in and I'll show you a ewer.
This is a ewer?
A ewer tape recorder.
Quarter-inch tape machine.
Okay, absolutely. And don't forget to put the tape in, Arthur. So I went down and I did my first radio interview about the first Simmental cattle coming in. And of course, the family were delighted to hear Arthur's voice on the radio. I was even more delighted with the £5 fee I got from the BBC.
It hasn't changed much nowadays.
And that started another seed growing that I wanted to do more of broadcasting. I liked the apparent simplicity of it and the closeness you could get with an individual that you somehow you can't get in a newspaper article. When I actually got my first job with the BBC at Radio Carlisle, it was really special. I was only there 2 years before I moved back to Scotland and the BBC in Aberdeen. But what made Carlisle so special was you were building something from scratch that had never been there before.
Working really stupid hours by the sound of it too.
I think it wasn't unusual for some of us in the newsroom and Radio Carlisle to put in a 100-hour week. But we never thought about that. We just loved what we were doing. And of course, because I had a farming background, I immediately had a good rapport with the dairy farmers from West Cumbria, Workington, Whitehaven, or the hill farmers in the Ullswater area. And it was good. And they knew that I knew a little bit about farming, and they had never had their own farming program before. So the rapport between the broadcaster and his audience was very special.
I wanted to ask you about that. Did you ever find that slightly schizophrenic? Because it must be, to a certain extent, a bit like being a war correspondent among soldiers. You know, you understand them, you can speak their language, but you are not one of them anymore.
No, that's absolutely correct. I wouldn't argue with that at all. It's, you know, when you get into the bigger areas of agri-politics, and I suppose political correspondents would tell you this in newspapers and broadcasting too, you don't want to get too close. I mean, I think you'll find some of the best broadcasters we've known on the BBC and ITV who are very much at the sharp end of what's happening in the nation, they will tell you that they don't actually go to parties or have people in their house. They like to maintain a little distance to ensure, hopefully, their objectivity.
What about the move to Aberdeen? How did that come out?
Because the big boss man of Aberdeen at that time was a man called Pat Chalmers, who went on to even greater things and became controller of BBC Scotland and head of post-productions in London. He and I had known each other very, very slightly, because in 1968, when I was on The Scotsman reporting, a tractor firm invited a group of journalists to Czechoslovakia. And being the two Scots on the trip, the rest of the journalists were from the south, Pat and I shared a room. So that's how we got to know each other. And he was from a farming background at Inverurie. Mm-hmm. They were looking for another producer for Farm Journal, which had moved from Queen Street to Aberdeen. And someone had suggested my name. Pat Chalmers came down, talked to my bosses at Radio Carlisle, listened to my output. And he said, well, there's a job going, but no promises. It'll be advertised and you can apply for it and take your chances. And I'll remember that day for the rest of my life when I was called to the interview. I had just finished producing the breakfast programme, because I did that 2 days a week. So I was up at 4:30 to get the morning papers, write the paper review and produce the programme on air. I had to interview in Glasgow at about, 11, 12 o'clock. The programme was off the air and I had time to do it. But Sod's Law dictated that it was foggy and raining and I was going to be late, and I hate being late. So I stopped on the A74 somewhere and phoned BBC in Glasgow where the interview was. And they said, well, come when you can. Got to Glasgow, couldn't find a parking space, ran like crazy to Broadcasting House, Queen Margaret Drive, where it was then. And then I said, and I was pouring with sweat, and what wasn't sweat was wet with rain. And the girl said, go straight up, they're waiting for you. And I went straight up to the Sanctum Sanctorum, the Holy of Holies, opened the conference door and saw the five figures at the board waiting for me. Ah, good morning, I'm sorry I'm late. Didn't see three steps and fell flat on my face on the carpet in the, in the conference room. Against all the odds, I got the job.
Sympathy, I think.
Very possibly.
How did Landward come about?
Well, I didn't start Landward. Pat Chalmers did. It originally started as a programme called Farm Forum, which was a monthly farming programme as an opt-out of a programme from Pebble Mill in Birmingham. But then when I came on board doing radio, the person who was assistant producer of television took early retirement. And I got a chance to sit on trial to be assistant producer to Pat Chalmers. And I had loads of ideas. I knew nothing about television, many of which he liked. So he managed to get the purse strings loosened a bit in Glasgow. So we doubled the output from a monthly opt-out to twice a month, 26 programmes a year.
How difficult was it to persuade the BBC that they should have a farming programme? Because it was a farming programme at that time.
Absolutely. I didn't have to persuade them. I left that to wiser heads, perhaps, in the management in BBC Glasgow. But I have to say, although Landward was a very cheap programme by television standards, nonetheless, there were forces within BBC in Glasgow who would have thought, you know, who often thought and often stated publicly, why do we need a farming programme? Why can't we cover just farming issues within the news programme? Because whatever Landward cost with salaries and budgets, Current Affairs could have used that. Music and Arts could have used that. Sport could have used that. But the BBC at senior management level took the view, and I supported them absolutely, that there was a constituency within public service broadcasting in Scotland that the rural voice should be heard, and that the people of rural Scotland should be clear that this was a programme about them and for them, but in an objective way.
Mm-hmm. I said right at the top, you know, your book's called Wheels Rolling at 8, and we would explain that. So now is the time. Explain that.
Well, it's...
I'm laughing because I remember vividly. My first real memory of you was in the Station Hotel in Dumfries. I looked at my window at 7:30 and you're pacing up and down, looking at your watch, waiting for the crew to come out, and the leave time was rolling at 8 o'clock.
Okay, well, yes, I'm glad you remembered that, but you were never late. No, it actually started in 1988, when I was in Australia doing two films for Landward in the bicentenary year of Australia. And one of the cameramen kind of had his own liberal interpretation of what I meant by an 8 a.m. start. So I remember losing my cool, as, you know, I insisted as gently as I dared that 8 a.m. didn't mean having the last cup of coffee, didn't mean paying the bill at reception, didn't mean packing the camera and all the gear into those silver cases. It meant in the car and wheels rolling. I mean, when I came up to BBC from in Aberdeen, from Carlisle, on my first day, everyone was laid down their pencils, as it were, and clattering typewriters at 10 o'clock and started to get up. I said, where's everybody going? We're going up right up to the top of the building, three floors up, where there was a kind of mini canteen. Oh, we always have a half-hour coffee break. I said, half-hour coffee break? So over the years, I mean, I sort of carried my Radio Carlisle training, because you tried to get 26 hours out of every 24 then. When I got to Landward, we didn't have a one-hour lunch break. Mm-hmm. I didn't stop for coffee in the morning. I didn't stop for a cup of afternoon tea. We cracked through it, making every best possible use. However, I always made sure that at the end of the day, when the work was done, we had a damn fine supper somewhere. Yes. And if that involved putting a bottle of house claret on the table, then so be it. I hold my hands up to that.
See, it's interesting, because it would have been very simple to go up to Aberdeen and say, right, we are a farming programme, it's a Scottish constituency, those are our borders. What I always admired about Landward across the years was you had ambition. You wanted to say, our reach is actually much, much broader than just, you know, Firth of Scotland.
Well, yeah, that's right, because I always thought that the world was changing, Europe and the rest of the world was changing economically, technically, politically, socially. And they used to joke that if there was a Scottish farmer farming anywhere in the world, Arthur Anderson would find him. But, you know, wherever I went in the world, there was a Scottish dimension to it. Mm-hmm. You could joke in a cynical way and say he always tried to throw a kilt around it. Yeah. But there was a Scottish dimension. And I hope that even when we did the scientist, Dr. Bob Orskoff from Aberdeen, when we filmed with him in China and Vietnam, there was a relevance which meant something to a Scottish farming and rural audience. Mm-hmm. And, if you like, a wider audience as well.
But you did do a lot of serious trips.
Absolutely. But some, I have to tell
Arthur you... Arthur Anderson's map of the world's got lots of pins on it.
I know. But I have to tell you that many, many long years ago, there was an advert in the Scottish Farmer looking for young men of ambition to farm in the Falkland Islands, the Falkland Islands Farming Company. And I thought, oh, there's a good idea. Let's get a couple of young farmers who go from Scotland and we'll do a film over there. And I went down and I had to do it all through the Foreign Office. And I remember going down and the Foreign Office chap and I had a most wonderful lunch in London, and which cost almost a programme budget. And I'd also arranged through the RAF, we hadn't got as far as buying the tickets, RAF from Bryce Norton, because mm-hmm. that's the only way you could go then. And I was all set up to go. And then a certain country called the Argentine decided to send in some troops. And my trip to the Falklands went astray. Went astray, but only for 20-odd years. And then there was a certain young reporter, very ambitious, and had, by that time had more energy than me, called Ewan McElraith. And I thought, I'll send him. And he went.
It was very good of you.
All three of us sitting around here just now are essentially in the same situation. You know, we're all passionately aware of the fact that agriculture, farming, rural management, land use, that kind of thing, is essential to Scottish life and culture. It's very, very important. But essentially, we're not directly involved. We're all observers. Now, as an observer, how has agriculture changed since you left the farm and the May all the way up to the present day? I mean, that's a huge question, but how would you define it?
It's changed dramatically. I mean, change is part of everyone's life. They used to say there was only two things in life that were certain, death and taxes, but there's a third one, and that's change. We had I told you earlier about the size of a farm we had, and my mother and father milked the cows, and yet even that small farm with that tiny income, they were able to afford somehow two full-time workers. These days are long gone. Even here in the heart of the Howe of the Mearns, where you've got some of the best farmers and some of the best farmland in Scotland, everything has shrunk in terms of manpower. The horsepower on the farm has got bigger. And farming is an increasingly stressful life and an increasingly lonely life. They say that, you know, there's so many farmers, and the average age of farmers now is late 50s, which doesn't augur well for the future. Some farmers will sit in their air-conditioned cabs, listening to the radio all day, and they never see or speak to anyone. And so that's difficult.
There's also changes you and I, Mark, were discussing about whether food is going to be a thing that farmers are involved in Scotland, because there are many people pulling very different ways, and the traditional, we're on the land to produce food, it's not as important as it was.
Well, I was at a conference and they were talking there about the concept of public goods. Basically, the idea of paying farmers for their contribution in terms of producing clean air, clean water, decent soil quality, that kind of thing. And somebody said at the conference, and I'll be honest, it shocked me, food is not a public good. And you're going, wait a minute. And I said, well, justify that statement. And she said, well, it's actually covered at the moment by the market. And I thought, no, it's not. It's covered by the market and single farm payments, but it is not covered by the market. A lot of people feel that's a dangerous viewpoint.
Yeah, well, it is actually, because the bottom line is, no matter how at any of these fancy conferences they dress it up in fancy psychobabble perhaps, there's one fundamental issue, and that is whoever we are, Whether you're a BBC producer or a space scientist or whatever, we all need to be fed. And that's a critical thing. I mean, I just reading the other day, and it's a startling fact. It's always startled me anyway. There are 7 billion people in the world. There are more people alive on the face of the Earth today than have ever lived in the whole history of the human race. That's startling, but it's true. And yet somehow, and they all need to be fed. And yet the land we have available is shrinking fast. 300 acres of land is lost to housing and industrial development across the world every day. We lose something like 3.4 tons of soil for every person on the face of the earth each year through compaction, acidification, salination, erosion. These issues are not quite so critical in the UK or Scottish terms, but we are one human race, and so we've got to watch fancy ideas about food, because food is of strategic importance to any nation.
Going back to being the producer of Landward, people constantly are trying to sell you a story. You know, I've watched you go around the Highland Show, and it's a constant stream of people saying, coming to my farm, cover this story. Why don't you do that? You're not a farming programme anymore. How did you cope with all that?
Oh, I just coped beautifully. I mean, I was a diplomat to the end. I mean, you listened to everyone politely and you then logged it in. You thought, that's not, there's not a story there. But you thought, hang on, there is a story there for the future. And you make a quiet little note. And when you get back to the office, you develop it and hope it comes, bears fruit.
Because that was another angle of it. An awful lot of stories just... I was speaking to Dave Gray, who's a producer up in Orkney, and I was walking past the door, and he was leaning up against the wall. I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm waiting for a story. Landward, to a certain extent, is like that as well. A lot of things come to your door because they trust you.
Uh-huh. Well, I hope so. I hope people would come, not because they saw us as an easy sell, but they saw us that... as a programme that would do them objective justice. And I hope we did.
Because you have to go back to people time and time again.
Absolutely, absolutely. But, you know, be objective if you can.
This is a really difficult question to answer, I'm sure, but say you were starting from scratch today, for sake of argument, say you're 25, find yourself in the BBC again, but could you have even vaguely the same career that, you know, that you enjoyed?
I honestly don't believe I could. No, I certainly don't believe I could do that.
And it's a much smaller pool too. If you actually count up the number of farmers that exist nowadays, the people directly involved with agriculture, fewer and fewer than there have ever been.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know what the percentage of the population is, but agriculture has continued to take a backseat politically as the rural population has shrunk. And for the politicians, they ignore agriculture at their peril. And of course, looking to the future, who knows what the future is? I've never in my 74 years lived at a time when there is so much political uncertainty. And it is quite distressing, actually. And who knows what's going to happen to farming and food production if this Brexit thing falls to pieces. Because the best land will always be farmed. But what happens to the farmers on the west coast of Scotland, in West Argyll, with a 70-inch rainfall, who can only manage perhaps a 60-70% lambing percentage? If they don't have a decent support, there's going to be a great drift from the land again, I reckon.
What was it like as you went through the door on the way out at the BBC? Were you a spring in your step or were you dragging your heels?
I think you make a decision that there's a time to go. And the time to go for me was right. And no, I didn't regret leaving, but that's not to assume in any way that I was glad to go. I loved my job and I was a very, very lucky guy.